Welcome back to Vocal Point. This is Jerry Newcomb, and as you may know, if you listen to this program, I really am very much interested in American history because, as they said in 1984 in that old novel, it said, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." And in some ways, there's a battle for the writing and rewriting of our history. And so we're going to talk right now with a retired journalist who spent years and years at the Dallas Morning News. In fact, I don't know if you remember this, sir, but I actually interviewed you many years ago in your office at the Dallas Morning News with a television crew. His name is William Murchison, and he's written a book called The Cost of Liberty, The Life of John Dickinson, who is one of our founding fathers. Mr. Murchison, or Bill, if I may call you that,
yes,
welcome
Bill,
to the program.
Bill, please, Jerry.
Sure. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to talk to you again, Jerry.
Sure.
I wish you could be here to bring the crew back by again, but I'm happy to talk to you on the telephone.
All right. Very good. All right. Well, tell us about John Dickinson. By the way, some people say that there's about 250 men that we could put into the category of founding fathers. That would include all the men that met in the Continental Congress and so forth. But John Dickinson has one of the distinctions in that he was there in the 1776 Continental Congress, 56 men who signed that document, and he was one of them. Tell us more about John Dickinson.
John Dickinson ought to be in the top five or six among the founding fathers, Jerry. He, not just the top 250, but the top five or six. He was that important. He was one of the founding fathers who did the most toward creating in the colonists the understanding that their liberties were being trespassed against and that they had to do something to retrieve those liberties, to protect them from British violations. And he was uniquely qualified to do this because he was a lawyer who had been trained in London, in the Middle Temple at London, as a young American who managed in that experience to acquire a profound respect for the tradition of British liberties. And he understood also that liberty did not come from the king. Liberty did not come from Parliament. It came from God. He understood that the rights that Americans were entitled to were first and foremost the rights that God had given his people, and that all other rights proceeded from that initial foundation of their freedoms by God. So he worked very eloquently in all of the leading continental assemblies that gathered to protest British intrusions on American rights. And that goes from the Stamp Act Congress to the convention that wrote the Federal Constitution. Jerry, the one thing John Dickinson did not do, which has unfortunately clouded his reputation in popular entertainment, was to sign the Declaration of Independence. He was a member of the Continental Congress. He did not sign the Declaration of Independence and has been maligned and stereotyped and caricatured. To a certain extent, this was true at the time, and this practice has informed the views of him that people may have seen in HBO series on John Adams.
Oh, yes.
And in the musical 1776, he was not against independence. He was for liberty, and he knew that liberty could not be found within the British connection at that point. What he thought in 1776 was that the time had not yet come because the colonies were not united, the colonies were not joined in a single purpose. There was much hesitation, much resistance to the idea of declaring independence. And second, that no one had done enough work to secure the support of foreign countries a military venture against the strongest country in the world, which was, of course, Great Britain. So Dickinson absented himself from the signing, from the vote on July 2nd, 1776, for independence. He did not vote against it. He simply kept away from it. And Pennsylvania, of which he was whose delegation he was a member of, voted for independence. The vote was taken, and John Dickinson left the Continental Congress to serve in uniform against the British Army.
Wow.
He was one of two members of the Continental Congress to do that.
Who was the other one? Who was the other one?
The other one was Thomas McCain of Delaware. He signed. He was a signer.
Right.
John Dickinson, a non-signer, and this is what makes his witness extraordinary. He, as one historian has put it, fought for what he could not vote for.
Hmm.
If that does not put things to right with history, I cannot imagine what would, except in the stubborn minds of people who are so purist as to imagine that it was possible to have conscientious doubts about the readiness of the colonies for independence.
All right, we're talking right now with Bill Murchison, who wrote The Cost of Liberty, The Life of John Dickinson. Now, wait, help me to understand this. Here he was meeting in the Continental Congress of 1776. He didn't vote for it, but he didn't vote against it. Sounds like one of our modern politicians. But what you're saying is that no, he did this out of conscience. But the bottom line is that he didn't actually sign it. I thought all 56 men eventually signed it, but no, that's not true.
He was the non-signer, and Robert Morris, his fellow delegate from Pennsylvania, a fellow delegate. There were several, of course.
Right, Ben Franklin. Yeah.
Also opposed the declaration, but changed his mind before the vote. Dickinson did not want to thwart what Pennsylvania's desire to vote for independence. That is why he kept away from the actual vote on independence. It was not a case of ducking the judgment of history. It was a case of simply standing aside and letting those who had expressed a sincere desire for independence to have their way.
All right. Now, prior to that vote in July 2nd, 1776, by the way, it's strange to me that July 2nd was the real day of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. Why yes. July 4th is singled out as the big day is kind of, I don't know, that's surprising. Do you have an answer to that? And then
Well, July 4th was when it was signed.
Well, no. It was signed later.
It was signed actually over a number of days.
Right. Beginning in August. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Into August. That's entirely correct.
Yeah.
But wait.
I remember what it is. Here it is. July 2, they vote for independence. July 4th, they vote to accept the Declaration of Independence with the alterations. And then starting in August, they start signing, and it's the last one to sign it, I believe, signed it in January of 1777. Okay, all right.
Theoretically, Dickinson could have signed at that point, but I think he resisted doing that because he had already made his stand. He had already said what he thought at the time that he thought it, and he decided to let that ride.
All right, so here's my question. Prior to Continental Congress, the Third Continental Congress meeting in 1776. Tell me some of the things John Dickinson did prior to that to help independence.
Well, he was a powerful exponent of the argument that Americans could not be taxed without representation. The turning point for him. And he being a staunch friend of the British connection, every drop of blood in my body is British, he said at one point. But the turning point for him, which was not a total turn, but was the Stamp Act.
Which was what year?
Sorry?
What year was the Stamp Act?
The Stamp Act was 1765, and he began to write at that time powerfully, eloquently against the right of the British government to tax the colonists without their consent. He continued to do that. The most powerful production that he was actually became famous for, though, and it made his name throughout the colonies, was the farmers' letters. They were letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania, and they were written by him and published anonymously in protest against the subsequent taxes that that Parliament laid on glass and paint and tea and lead, and he became a colonial hero from his letters from a farmer. He wrote 12 of them, and they were the cause of a doctorate that he received from Princeton University, of toasts being given when to him all throughout the colonies, to the farmer. People saw him as the exponent of their liberties. He understood that the people's right in the colonies to enjoy the security of their property depended on their ability to protect that property from unreasonable intrusion by Parliament across the sea. And he was terribly eloquent in his manner of putting his case before the public. He was one of the great minds in the colonies, as a matter of fact. He became a friend of Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was a member of a younger generation, but nonetheless, Dickinson and Jefferson warmly admired each other, although Dickinson did not sign the document for which Thomas Jefferson is most famous. Mm. And when Dickinson died in 1808, Jefferson called him one of the great worthies of the Revolution.
Wow.
So their views were consonant. They overlapped. It was about liberty, and the need for the foundation of the United States to rest upon a commitment to the liberties of the people.
Well, I think one of the things that's happened, Bill, as you well know, is in modern America there's such a dearth of knowledge on the part of so many. It's so sad about our true history, and so the average person doesn't even know a lot of these things. Jay Leno will go out on the street sometimes and actually ask people, I don't know if you've ever seen those things. He's done man in the street interviews around the time of July 4th, and he'll say, okay, what are we celebrating on July 4th? Fireworks, people don't know. And then he'll even ask, independence from what, or independence from whom? And the guesses are all over the place. And Germany, it's just amazing. But there's such widespread ignorance that it'd be amazing if the average American today could name maybe four or five founding fathers, much less someone like John Dickinson.
Oh, I agree. I'm not sure they know. They have any very clear idea of who Franklin, Jefferson, and Madison were. And they have even less idea, of course, about who Dickinson was.
Sure.
Not to mention the entire roster of founding fathers, which was quite glorious.
Yeah, absolutely. But, all right, well, let me ask you a question. You've been involved in journalism, and then also you've done a column, right, I believe, for a while?
I'm still writing a syndicated columnist. I'm not retired by any means.
Are you retired from the newspaper?
I retired from the Dallas News in 2001, at the end of 2001.
Okay.
I immediately became Radford Distinguished Professor of Journalism at Baylor University.
Oh, good for
Waco.
You.
I taught at Baylor for 5 years, And then I returned to Dallas, where I continued to work. I get up and put on a necktie every day and come to my office work as hard as I can. I love it.
Good.
There's a lot to do.
So tell me, how did you decide to write a book on John Dickinson? I mean, there must have been some sort of event that happened or something that you found that you were like, oh, man, the whole world should know about this.
Well, Jerry, actually, I was asked to write a book on John Dickinson, and it was amenable to me because I had some years earlier been only peripherally aware of John Dickinson. I knew that he was consequential. I knew he was a founding father, and I had seen John Dickinson portrayed in 1776. He was a ruffian. He shouted at John Adams at one point during 1776. I'm talking about the portrayal on the stage and in the movie. He and John Adams went at each other with sticks on the floor of the Continental Congress. He called Adams things such as incendiary little man and madman. He was an arrogant opponent of John Adams. In the HBO series, I was already becoming conversant with John Dickinson. He was a furtive little creature who looked down when he talked and muttered.
I remember that. Yeah, and he had a wig, I think. Well, of course, a lot of them did, too.
And he took his wig off. And when John Adams came to visit him in his room and talked him into absenting himself, which none of that ever happened. John Dickinson was an ordinary man. He was, that is to say, in the physical sense, there were no particular hindrances that he was party to. But he was a man with a profound mind, who understood history, he understood political philosophy, and the more I knew about him, Jerry, to get back to your question, the more entertaining became the idea of finally interpreting John Adams to the American public.
Now, John Dickinson.
Two biographies of Dickinson that were out there, if you call it out there, one of them was written in the 19th century, the other was written in 1962.
Wow.
There had not been a biography since 1962.
Wow.
Think of how many books on Jefferson there have been since then.
I'm working on one right now.
Franklin.
Yeah.
And it was time for one on Dickinson, so I heartily and readily embraced the cause, and I've had a lot of fun with it. It's wonderful telling the story of a man like him.
Well, that's great. Now, I understand the Wall Street Journal has praised even this book.
Yes, I was very pleased about that. And I think that it was a logical book, if I may say so, for the Journal to take up, because the Journal is, as one might well imagine, profoundly committed to the maintenance of American liberties and to repelling challenges to American liberties. And John Dickinson... Well, he would have been a Wall Street Journal reader if they'd had the paper back in those days. But their philosophies were very consonant. They crossed in many places.
Hmm. Well, there's a professor from Hillsdale College who said this, quote, "John Dickinson is the most neglected of the true giants of the American War for Independence. Bill Murkison has written a book finally and fully worthy of the author of more of our nation's founding documents than any other man. This biography will stand for the ages." That's great. Congratulations.
I'm very appreciative.
Yeah.
Very, very appreciative of that. I would like not so much for the book to stand, but for John Dickinson's memory to stand. He deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great man, and I'm trying to make that case in all instances and in all forums in which I'm given a chance. And I appreciate the chance that you've given me today to talk about him. People need to know about him.
So why was he called the penman of the Revolution?
Well, that's a very good question, Jerry. And the reason was that he wrote most of the major documents, or at least contributed heavily to writing most of the major documents that were addressed to the British protesting their intrusions on colonial rights. He was a wonderful writer. He had a great skill, a great facility with the pen, and he was also very deeply read, much more so than most Americans at that time. in philosophy, in history, and in law, of course. And he was able to fish from his great capacious mind a lot of not just facts but reasonings that made the case in a way that few Americans could probably have made it on paper. He wrote, among other things, the protest to the Crown over the Stamp Act. He wrote the Declaration on the Causes and Necessities of Taking Up Arms, in which he tried to impress on the British the colonials' resolution to fight if they had to. He wrote the first draft of the Articles of Confederation.
Oh, wow.
Which formed the basis of American government.
Right.
And then he was a member of the Annapolis Convention that convened the Constitutional Convention, and he was in poor health at this time, and had to miss various sessions of the Constitutional Convention, although it was held in his hometown, Philadelphia. But he made his views known, and he said some remarkably true and eloquent things about liberty and the rights of the people under a free government. So he made his impress on the Constitution just as he had made it on so many other great documents of the Revolutionary period.
You know, it's funny, when you mention the Articles of Confederation, this was our first form of government. It predates the Constitution by about eight years in terms of its effect. It went into effect 1781. The Constitution went into effect 1789 and was, of course, written in 1787. But here's a great trivia question. Who was the first president of the United States? Do you know the answer? It's John Hanson.
Well.
The first president of the United States was John Hanson. He was the first president under the Articles of Confederation. So when we say George Washington was the first president of the United States, what we're really saying is he was the first president of the U.S. under the Constitution. But, again, the Articles predated it by several years. And you're saying that that this guy, John Dickinson, was the first author, or he wrote the first draft of the Articles.
Yes, they were. The people who finally brought the Articles into being were working off Dickinson's template.
I see.
So he had a major hand in forming the government. Dickinson did in years in the early to mid 1780s become very unhappy with the lack of authority in the federal government. The Congress had made the government, the central government, weaker than Dickinson thought was efficient for the conduct of a government.
Right.
And so he was a leader of those who wanted to strengthen the Articles of Confederation, or as it happened at that Annapolis meeting, which issued the call to
revise them.
To set it aside, set the Articles aside and proceed with a new Constitution.
Right. Well, as it's my understanding that when the Founding Fathers actually met in the summer of 1787 and they produced the Constitution, so we call it the Constitutional Convention, initially the goal was to essentially revise the Articles of Confederation, and then one of the delegates from Virginia stood up and said, look, let's start all over, and they did.
That was pretty much the state of thinking at that time in 1787, because people had really kind of had it with the Constitution,
with the
Articles of Confederation. They were simply too weak. There were too many instances where states could not cooperate and violated each other's what they did. Regarded as their rights, and it wasn't working. It was a good idea, but it hadn't really worked.
Sure.
It was time to replace it.
All right, we have a couple minutes left. What would you like to say about John Dickinson that you haven't said? Do we have the United States? I mean, did he play a major role in helping us get our rights and our freedoms under God in this country?
Oh, yes, he did. The words that he wrote stirred the American people to a new appreciation of their rights under God and of the value of their liberties. And they required a government that would guarantee those liberties and would ensure those liberties far into the future. I happen to think that Dickinson is a man for today. I think we could very much take him as a model of prudent and enlightened statesmanship, such as we don't have very much of today. He was a man of great intellectual power and a man of great dignity and a man with a prophetic sense who looked beyond the immediate consequences of particular enactments or proposals to the long-term consequences. He could see. It was as if he were standing high above the tumult and looking down the years to the coming events and the coming circumstances. He could envision in his mind, his very great capacious mind, the likely results of particular ideas. And he was ideally suited by nature, by philosophy, by temperament, to act as one of the great expositors of American rights at this crucial moment when American rights won their guarantee on the battlefield and then required protection by a system of government that would respect them and make sure that those rights were forever fundamental to the American experience.
And where was John Dickinson coming from as far as faith, or was he an active member of any particular church?
Well, that's an excellent question, too. John Dickinson was born a Quaker. Now, he wasn't a very good Quaker, the scholars believe. His family.
Well, yeah, you said he later on went to become a soldier, and that would violate the Quaker teaching.
Well, it would. There were certain that certainly would be regarded as a violation of the necessity of peaceful
right.
gestures in all settings. But he repudiated. He didn't repudiate his Quaker connection. He simply lived his life as an Orthodox Christian, capital C Christian, without a particular connection to a particular denomination. He often attended the Episcopal Church throughout his later years, but he did not join that church, and he never left the Quaker connection. He is buried in the Quaker burial ground in Wilmington, Delaware. So the Quakers got him in the end. But they nevertheless were not close. There had been a ruction between Dickinson's father over the Quaker meeting's objection to the marriage of a member of the family to a non-Quaker.
Oh, I see.
And so the Dickinsons, as a family, pulled back from the Quakers. He married a Quaker woman, and
The father did, or the son?
Dickinson.
John Dickinson
himself
okay.
did. He married a Quaker lady, one of the great families of Pennsylvania she belonged to, and they respected the Quakers, but he thought the Quakers were a little bit much for him.
Okay. All right. Well, we're basically out of time. Where can people get this book, The Cost of Liberty, which is the life of John Dickinson?
Certainly Barnes & Noble, certainly Amazon.com is a good source.
All right, very good. And again, we've been talking with William Murchison. Murchison is spelled Murchison. Well, thank you so much for being with us. All the best to you.
Terry, thank you very much. I appreciate
okay.
it a lot.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.